When Jean Seberg was growing up in Marshalltown, she was convinced that she would one day be a movie star. And then she made it happen. She would go on to star in 37 films. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The documentary Movie Star, The Secret Lives of Jean Seberg, will premiere at the 3rd Annual Jean Seberg International Film Festival in Marshalltown next week. This hour, I'll talk with Kelly and Tammy Rundle, the filmmakers behind the documentary, Seberg's biographer, a scholar who has studied her films, and one of the organizers of the film festival. We'll talk about her life, her work, and her tragic end. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Jean Seberg grew up in Marshalltown. She became an international movie star and lived most of her adult life in Paris. She starred in 37 films and is possibly best remembered for her role in the movie Breathless, at the forefront of the French New Wave movement. The documentary Movie Star, The Secret Lives of Jean Seberg, will premiere at the 3rd Annual Jean Seberg International Film Festival in Marshalltown next week on Friday, the 15th. Although the premiere is sold out, there will be subsequent showings on Saturday and Sunday. And with me in the studio today are Kelly and Tammy Rundle, the filmmakers behind the documentary. Thank you both for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
We're happy to be here.
And we're going to talk this hour with a lot of people who know a great deal about Jean Seberg and her work. But in the documentary, you go back and you visit with people, of course, who knew her best, including her sister. And you start to tell us a little bit about her childhood. And I would love to play just a moment from the film. This is her sister talking about when they were kids together.
It was innate. From the time she was tiny, she was acting. She was performing. Whenever I think of Jean and I as children, I always think about lying in our twin beds and mother saying, okay, it's time to do the dishes, or it's time to clean the bedroom, or it's time to make your bed. And Jean would just lie there and read her book on brain surgery or whatever. Her standard response was, I don't have to learn how to do that. I'm never going to have to do that. I'm going to grow up and be a movie star, and I'm going to have a maid who will do all my work.
Just a moment from the film, and it gives us the idea that Jean Seberg always planned on being a movie star. But as you did your research, it seems that everybody in Marshalltown thought Jean Seberg was going to grow up to be a movie star.
She stood out in a way that I certainly did not when I was that age, and in a way that I'll never stand out. But yeah, there was something special about Jean. About that idea of wanting to be an actress from a very early age. And that's always impressive to me when anybody has got those kind of concepts figured out early on in life. But, you know, thankfully, you know, Tammy and I partnered with Gary McGee on this project. And Gary, over 20 years ago, gathered that interview that you just played a clip from. And thank goodness that he did, because that material has been a great asset to the project.
And did you go back to Marshalltown and find other people who knew Jean when she was growing up?
When we came on board, what we wanted to do was to take the older material and create a new framework for it, and to add some additional interviews. So we did do some new interviews in Marshalltown, and also in Oakland, California, and in other places in the Midwest.
And she was born in, was it 1938?
Correct.
Yeah, she'll be 75 years this year. This would have been her 75th birthday.
So there are still a few people around who knew her.
Oh, yes.
Yes, she has quite a following all over the world. It's amazing how many emails and people who will contact us from France and England and Japan, as well as throughout the United States. She still has a huge following.
Well, I want to bring, we have a lot of people who know a lot about Jean Seberg here with us today, and I want to bring Gary McGee, you just mentioned, into the conversation. He's the author of a number of books about Jean Seberg and her work, including Breathless, Neutralized, the FBI versus Jean Seberg. Hi, Gary.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And Richard Ness is also with us. He's a professor of film and media studies at Western Illinois University. Hello, Rich. Rich, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
Hi, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Well, and Gary and Rich, the two of you go back quite a ways, right, Rich?
Yeah, he was a student of mine at Iowa State more than 20 years ago.
Thanks.
It was in Rich's class that you first learned about Gene Seberg?
Oh, no, I had known about Gene, growing up, and but it was Rich showing Breathless in one of his film studies classes that he spoke a little bit about Breathless, and then he spoke about Jean's life. And just in those 4 or 5 minutes, I was very intrigued by her story. And since Marshalltown's just about 30 miles from Ames, I thought, you know, I'm going to go over there this weekend and see what I can find out. So he kind of relit the fire there with Jean.
Well, and Rich, when you showed Breathless, which, of course, as I mentioned, was at the forefront of the French New Wave, what was it that you said about this film? What does this film mean to you?
I actually had two or three different films that I would show in conjunction with the French New Wave, so I didn't always show Breathless, and it just was, you know, one of these lucky situations that Gary happened to be in this semester that I showed that film and talked about Gene Seberg. And I always joke if he'd taken the class where I showed Jules Jim, he'd probably be doing a documentary on Jean Moreau right now. But I think that the film just... sort of broke all kinds of new ground in terms of the non-linear editing style and just the way he would have characters directly address the camera. And so it's sort of a catalog of all the new wave techniques that became popular with other filmmakers. And it just kind of crystallizes what that whole period was like, young filmmakers with handheld equipment just going out and trying things that nobody had done before.
And it strikes me as very strange that an American woman from Marshalltown, Iowa, is the star of that movie. How did Jean Seberg get into Breathless?
Well, she actually had done had some connections in France already, and I think she had decided that her Hollywood career was, you know, probably going to be relegated to smaller roles if she stayed with. I think she had a contract at Columbia at the time, Godard was looking for, I think, an idea of contrasting French lifestyle with American lifestyle. And so he created these two characters. You know, it's sort of telling that she sells the New York Herald Tribune in Paris. That's her job, is selling the newspapers. So he has this whole sort of media undercurrent as well that runs through the film.
Well, and Gary, seeing this film and learning about Jean Seberg launched you on a life's quest to learn about her life and share her story with other people. What was it that you saw and heard that day that sent you on this journey?
Well, because she contributed to the French New Wave in a way that she really hadn't been recognized. You know, a lot of people will give Godard the credit and other filmmakers, as well as Jean-Paul Belmondo, who was her co-star. But Jean Seberg was kind of to the wayside. But then really, it's like this film really, I don't feel, would have been embraced by the mass audiences had it not been shown. And if it wasn't Jean Seberg in it, then I don't think a lot of people would have seen the film. So really, just to give Jean her credit due is really part of the story, why I wanted to get Jean's story out there.
Well, and you became involved with the Rundles. That's how this film came about. But Kelly, how did that happen? How did Gary get in touch with you?
Well, I think maybe it was even 7 years ago, Gary. I don't know if that's the right number, but... I got a phone call at our apartment in Los Angeles, and Tammy and I didn't realize it at that moment, but we were in our last 2 years living out there of 18 that we lived in L.A. But Gary was telling us about the film, and I think maybe he had heard about our first documentary, Villisca, Living with a Mystery, and That was in theaters in the Midwest. And we just had a conversation about it. And I kind of thought, well, maybe he was looking for a co-producer, but I wasn't sure. And we did run into Gary after we moved here in 2007 at the Iowa Independent Film Festival and began talking about partnering to complete this wonderful project that he had started a number of years before.
And so at that point, when you started working together, Gary obviously had been working on this for some time, but at what point did you get into the project? Where did you start?
Well, Gary had done some wonderful interviews in 1991, I think it was, and then also or 1990. Gary, help me.
Yeah, 90. I think it was 91, and then again
99.
In 99, the European yeah. month.
Mm-hmm. So we knew we had that material, and we also found got in touch with a collector in Los Angeles of Gene Seberg, probably the largest collection of Gene Seberg memorabilia in the world, and he's been helping us. And so we just tried to figure out how can we most effectively tell this story and give the finished film a contemporary look. And we had some new interviews that we were able to do. We had support for the project from, again, Gary did too, from Humanities Iowa and from the Iowa Arts Council. So just a lot of great things came together, a lot of resources to help us tell the story.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. As we said, Jean Seberg, growing up in Marshalltown, Iowa, wanted to be a movie star. Everybody around her seemed to take notice. She did some plays in high school, and people thought, wow, that girl is going to go far. And she got involved in a talent search. We have a moment from the film that is just a little bit of audio from a screen test that she did. Let's listen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What's your name?
My name is Jean Seberg.
Where were you born?
In Marshalltown, Iowa.
When?
November 13th, 1938.
That makes you what age?
17. And 11 months.
And 11 months, almost
mm-hmm.
18.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to be an actress?
Very badly.
But just a moment from the film, and we do need to take a break here, but we will get back to finding out how that happened, how she got involved in the talent search, how the director, Otto Preminger, found her and turned her into a movie star. Her career after that, we'll continue to talk about her life and the very, very sad story of her death. That's coming up in just a few minutes. I'm talking with the filmmakers behind the new documentary, Movie Star, The Secret Lives of Jean Seberg. Kelly and Tammy Rundle are here with me. Gary McGee, also involved in that project and the author of a number of books about Jean Seberg and her work. Richard Ness is here. He's a professor of film and media studies at Western Illinois University. And coming up in just a moment, we'll also talk with Nancy Adams, who's one of the organizers of the Jean Seberg International Film Festival in Marshalltown. And that's coming up next week. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about the actress Jean Seberg. She grew up in Marshalltown, Iowa. She became an international movie star. She starred in 37 films and died very young at the age of 40. The new documentary, Movie Star, The Secret Lives of Jean Seberg, will premiere next week at the Jean Seberg International Film Festival in Marshalltown. And the people behind the film are here with me today. Kelly and Tammy Rundle are here. And also Gary McGee, who's an author of a number of books about Jean Seberg and worked with the Rundles on this film. Richard Ness is also here. He's a professor of film and media studies at Western Illinois University. And Gary, let's talk about that screen test and how it was that Jean Seberg became part of that talent search that really launched her career. How did that happen?
Well, that was the talent search that Otto Preminger, the director, producer, had conducted, and it was internationally publicized. And at the time, Jean was on the East Coast doing summer stock right after her high school graduation. And the people there, it was Priscilla Beach, were impressed with her that they submitted her name. And she knew that they had submitted her name for this competition. And Jean said that she's not going to get it. They probably have someone else already selected. Meanwhile, in Marshalltown, The local millionaire, Bill Fisher, was very impressed with Jean, and he contacted her high school drama coach. And she asked her, and her name was Carol Hollingsworth, to go down and sign your name to this form because, you know, she should get the role. And anyway, so what transpired was Preminger was interested, and it led to, I think it was a casting call in Chicago with several other potential.
Wasn't it a huge number, like 1,200 other?
I think it was something like that, yes. And in fact, the person sitting next to her was Julie Summers, who ended up several years later starring in, I think, the TV show The Governor and J.J. So that was quite interesting. And so, Jean, in the end, it came down to three or four candidates, and Jean was selected.
And so she's selected to star in Joan of Arc.
St. Joan.
Oh, St. Yep. Joan, right. St. Mm-hmm. Joan, playing Joan of Arc. And
correct.
This huge production. And she had this strange relationship with Otto Preminger, too. Can you describe their relationship for me?
Well, from what Jean's sister told me, it was a love-hate relationship as the filming went on. Jean was very grateful for the opportunity, but did not appreciate how he treated her at times. And other co-stars in other films regarded Preminger as the Führer. Not that I can speak German very well, but, you know, that's not very complimentary. But then he would show a very kind side to other actresses and actors he worked with, including Jean Tierney, when she went through some terrible things in her private life. But, you know, Jean just accepted, you know, this is the way it is. And
So it's this huge, huge production. She has very little experience. And you look at pictures from the film, she is incredibly beautiful, luminous on the screen. But critics just panned the film. Richard, when you look at this film and other very early work of Jean Seberg, what do you see?
Actually, I think she's sort of been unfairly regarded for St. Joan, and I think it's because of all of the buildup, because it really was sort of essential to get an actress who wasn't trying to act in that film. The whole idea of, you know, Joan of Arc being overwhelmed by this patriarchal power structure that, you know, is challenging her and putting her on trial, you know, it tied in very well to Jean's sort of naive feeling at being surrounded by all of these, you know, Hollywood people, and particularly Preminger, tyrannical director. So I, watching the film again and sort of reevaluating it, I thought she, you know, brought to the role what it needed. Far stranger to me in that movie is Richard Widmark's performance as this kind of fey character. I think, you know, the criticism of Jean seems kind of out of proportion to some of the other performances in the film. And then you see her a year later in another Preminger film, Bonjour Tristesse, where she gets to play something that's a little closer to her range at the time. And she's quite good in that film.
Although, again, not a critical success.
No, but, you know, the critics had already sort of formulated an opinion about her, which may be one of the reasons why the move to France and the appearance in Breathless was kind of essential to her, because the American critics, it seemed like once they had decided on a scenario for a particular performer, whether it was Seberg or somebody else, you know, it was hard to break out of that. It was hard to convince them that, you know, she was more of an actress than they'd given her credit for. It's interesting to read little capsule statements about her in various film encyclopedias, and they say she never realized her full potential, and you're wondering what potential was this they thought she hadn't realized, because you look at her filmography, and in the first 5 years of her career, she's doing a comedy with Peter Sellers, she's doing a period drama with Preminger, a contemporary drama with Preminger, this French New Wave, you know, iconic film. So there's an interesting range of work there. You know, any young actress in the first few years of her career would envy the number of different things that Jean was actually cast in.
Well, and Kelly, how did she personally deal with the critics panning these films? I mean, this was she had so little experience. She was thrust onto the international scene, and then people said she was no good.
I think almost anyone that I can think of would have withered under that incredible criticism. And I think Jean did have to regroup after St. Joan and have a go again. And she said, you know, I didn't have the full grasp on my, you know, my craft. And she had to go back to the basics in a sense to learn, you know, to get up to speed, if you will, for film acting. But yeah, I don't know how she did it. Again, this is just one of those remarkable things about Jean Seberg to pick herself up at that age and to have the composure to move on. It's incredible. There's an interview that she did with Mike Wallace, and Wallace, you know, interviews her as if she'd embezzled money from, you know, the Bank of England or something. And she just it's amazing someone so young could, you know, withstand that, you know, that incredible grilling that he gave her.
Well, his questions, I mean, really were not kind.
No, and I think there's something to this idea that what Rich said, that when I read the reviews of her films after St. Joan, and I've seen the films, I see a disconnect. I see a tendency to sort of just talk about the same themes over and over again, ignoring the actual performance and how good it was.
I want to bring Nancy Adams into the conversation now. She's one of the organizers of the Jean Seberg International Film Festival and the director of the Jean Seberg Archival Collection at the Orpheum Theater Center in Marshalltown. Hello, Nancy.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for giving us airtime for Jean. It's a joy.
Well, you know, I grew up in Iowa, and I had never heard of Jean Seberg until I was in college, and I took a film class at Iowa State University, and I watched Breathless, and the professor mentioned that, oh, this is an actress from Iowa, and I thought, what? How is that possible? And I wonder, in Marshalltown and around the rest of the state, as her career moved on and she made a lot of French movies, and some of them quite racy French movies,
yes.
How was she thought of as a hometown girl?
I can give you my perspective of having been a transplant. I'm born and raised in Chicago, but I have lived in Marshall County for 19 years now. And what is stunning to me is that I had lived in that community for a full 6 years in her hometown before I heard her name. And that, now that I know of her and have studied her and so on, is stunning to me when we recognize the extent of her influence, the charm, the intelligence, the curiosity that she displayed. I just, the fact that I didn't know of her, and I'm someone who was very involved in the community, I think spoke to the fact that Marshalltown had sort of, if not moved on from Jean, then perhaps put her on a shelf for some time. And I know that when Gary and I have spoken of his early efforts in Marshalltown with a film festival and with talking to people and things, he, and correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but found very much the same thing as if Marshalltown had forgotten her.
Well, Gary, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, that's true. Or did not want to have anything to do with her.
I was going to ask that. I mean, is this a forgetfulness, or was this, you know, she was in some racy movies and some weird things happened, and maybe we don't want to talk about her.
Right. Well, the racy movies, you know, today very tame, and if you look back at them, there's no nudity. It's more the themes.
Yeah. And I think that actually was a sort of a bit of both, because there were people of many generations, right, who had literally never heard of her. And there were some people, for sure, when we first started to try to raise money to save the theater where the premiere will be held, we would truly consider the group that we were speaking to and wonder if we wanted to, if it was wise to talk about how we wanted Jean to be a part of the eventual project. Because there were some, I think, difficult feelings and or lingering judgments. And when we did have our first festival 2 years ago, it seemed perfect, really, that so much time had passed, because we could introduce or reintroduce Jean, bring her back home in a climate that was perhaps now ready.
Well, and Kelly and Tammy, I would like you to weigh in on this as well. I mean, as you were looking for people who could talk about Jean, what was the sense that you got about how people felt about her?
I think it's been sort of hinted at. I mean, we interviewed an older resident who knew Jean when she was very young, and he said that when she, and I think the phrase he used, went international, that's kind of when she fell off of his radar. And I think that's speaking for a lot of folks in Marshalltown. I know when we've been back there a number of times working on the film and to the film festival and other things, that if you're in a town long enough, you hear something unfortunate being said. And oftentimes the things that are said and the things that people think aren't even true. And that's a difficulty with Jean's life also, is that there's a lot of mythology that gets repeated on the internet and elsewhere that isn't necessarily even true. And yet that's how, you know, people characterize their ideas of her.
I think that is partially what the motivation of our working with Gary on mm-hmm. the film mm-hmm. was, to help to kind of clear up a lot of that misinformation that's out there, because mm-hmm. it's not really fair.
Well, and Nancy, as you're reintroducing Jean to people, I mean, I can't stop looking at pictures of this yeah. woman. I mean, she was so luminous, yeah. so beautiful. What kind of reaction do you get from people who hadn't heard of her?
Jean maintains the capacity, I think, to captivate people simply by her presence, right, on film or in pictures. And so there is almost an instant curiosity, who was this woman, right? And as they learn bits and pieces, the number of films that she made, her valiant efforts on behalf of social activism causes, it's pretty easy, I think, for people to get inspired by her and want to know more. And the one of the purposes, besides bringing Jean back home, of the festival has been to both celebrate who she was, and to educate. Her life and her career was so multifaceted that it seems almost endless in terms of the possibilities of topics for conversation or enduring influence. She's quite frankly an easy sell, right? if people will give you a moment of their time, it's a done deal, sort of.
Right. Well, and Kelly, when you talk to people about her beauty, what do people say about that knew her?
It's hard for them to describe it. One of the people we interviewed, were fortunate to interview, was Elaine Brown, the former head of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California. And Elaine talked about that because she said, you know, I have a really high standard for beauty. And she talked about some of the people she thought were beautiful, like Lena Horne, for example. And when she began to talk about Jean's beauty, you said the word luminous, mm. ethereal, she said fairy-like. I mean, she said she just had such beautiful symmetry. And she said, you know, for me to say she was beautiful, that's something, you know. But I think a lot of people felt that way. And maybe that was a little intimidating. But Jean also had this ability to have a conversation with anyone and not mm-hmm. to pretend that she was interested in what you were saying, but she was interested in what you were saying, and, mm-hmm. and she cared about what you were saying. Mm-hmm. So that's another aspect of Jean's personality that's just remarkable, I think, yeah. For someone operating at that level of celebrity.
Well, and clearly she was an incredibly intelligent woman. I mean, yes. and just the fact that she was able to make that transition to France and act in French. Although I have to say that when I first saw the movie Breathless, it was subtitled and I didn't really pay any attention to the sound because I don't speak French. This time, looking at clips from Breathless and listening to her talk, I can very clearly hear her Iowa accent mm-hmm. in her very perfect French. That's such it's really a wonderful sound, Nancy.
Yes. Yeah, I would concur. I'm just thinking back on some of the letters that we have in our collection, you know, the letters handwritten by Jean to her friends back home. And we've been the repository of just a remarkable and varied, collection. People want these things to be seen now. And one of the letters Jean wrote when she was filming in London, she wrote from her hotel room, and she talked about the French lessons, and she talked about how they were going, and she was determined to master it. She talked about horseback riding lessons. that she was taking at the time. She talked about eating food service in the hotel room and being a bit lonely. And these letters are peppered with very age-appropriate kinds of interests as well. You know, what was happening back home, what was happening between so-and-so and so-and-so. And just really, they're lovely snippets of who she was at the time, where she was at the time, and what she was, you know, engaged in. They're remarkable.
Well, we are going to take another short break, and we'll get back to our conversation in a moment. We will talk more about the personal life of Jean Seberg, also her life as an activist, and then what happened in her final months and years that led to what has been deemed a suicide, although there are many questions still about Jean Seberg's death. This hour, we're talking about Jean Seberg, and the documentary Movie Star, The Secret Lives of Jean Seberg, will premiere next week at the 3rd Annual Jean Seberg International Film Festival in Marshalltown. With me in the studio are the filmmakers, Kelly and Tammy Rundle. Also, Gary McGee was involved in making this film, and he's the author of a number of books about Jean Seberg and her work, including Neutralized, the FBI versus Jean Seberg. Also with me, Richard Ness, a professor of film and media studies at Western Illinois University, and Nancy Adams, one of the organizers of the Jean Seberg International Film Festival and the director of the Jean Seberg Archival Collection at the Orpheum Theater Center in Marshalltown. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Jean Seberg, a movie star who grew up in Marshalltown, Iowa. She went on to star in 37 films and is probably best remembered for her role in the movie Breathless, which was at the forefront of the French New Wave movement. The new documentary Movie Star, The Secret Lives of Jean Seberg, will premiere next week at the 3rd Annual Jean Seberg International Film Festival in Marshalltown. And I have a full house today with filmmakers Kelly and Tammy Rundle, also Gary McGee, the author of a number of books about Jean Seberg and also involved in making this documentary happen. Richard Ness is here. He's a professor of film and media studies at Western Illinois University, and also Nancy Adams, one of the organizers of the Jean Seberg International Film Festival in Marshalltown. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Gary, I want to go back to you. We've talked a little bit about her transition into films in Europe, and as her career was going on, she also had a very full personal life with a first marriage that didn't last that long to a French man who was really about her age. And then later on, she married a man who was significantly her senior. Let's talk a little bit about her second marriage.
Okay, yes. Jean was married to Raymond Guéry, who was a very famous French author, winner of the Prix Goncourt, which is the top literary prize in France, and also a French consul general in Los Angeles when Jean first met him. And he was very good friends with Charles de Gaulle, so that brought Jean kind of into the French political arena, if you'd like to say that.
And they were a very popular couple in Paris.
They were. For several years, they had Paris at their feet, from what we learned from someone from that time was telling us about that. So that's, you know, that puts Jean on a certain level that, you know, we in Iowa don't really fully understand.
Well, and in the film, I was surprised there was a moment when her sister, and I guess this was an interview you did, Gary, when her sister was talking about how Jean introduced her first child to her parents, to the child's grandparents. And that struck me as a little odd, the story. Did she kind of have a break with her family? Was there a period of time when she was not communicating with them as well?
Oh, no, she always did, but Jean was not married to Raymond when she had his child, and she just, I guess, you know, taking it at that time period in, you know, 62, you know, how do you tell your parents this when you're living half a world away?
So she didn't.
She didn't until Ed and Dorothy Seberg was visiting her and Raymond, and Jean brought out Diego, her son, her and Roman's son, and introduced them to him. This is your grandson.
As time went on and her career evolved, she became more politically involved, and not just in Europe, but in the United States as well. And how did she become involved with the Black Panther Party in the United States?
Jean was on a flight, and the man sitting next to her had this Montessori school in Watts. And so Jean was listening to him about the needs for that school. And that man, Hakeem Jamal, introduced Jean to members of the Black Panther Party, including Elaine Brown.
And I know, Kelly and Tammy, this was a part of her life that you explored as well. She gave money to support the breakfast program at that Montessori school. How much do we know about her involvement with other parts of the Black Panther Party?
The Montessori school was actually a separate endeavor, and I think Hakeem Jamal was not formally a member of the Black Panther Party, but I think he understood that Jean was someone who was supportive of these types of humanitarian endeavors, and that she had money and was willing to donate her money. That's another consistent theme in Jean's life, concern for other people, and this was just an extension of that. And so, yeah, when she got involved with the Panthers, you know, they met with her and she wanted to know what they were doing and what they were all about. And I think her entry into supporting them was their free breakfast program. So that's how she got involved. And we were fortunate to be able to interview Elaine Brown, who was one of her two contacts with the party. And they were not only, you know, I guess working together in this way, but they were friends as well. So it was very interesting to talk to Elaine and get that first-hand account of what had happened back in those days.
Well, and you mentioned that this was a consistent thing for her, helping out people who needed assistance. She was also involved with the Meskwaki tribe in Iowa, right?
Correct.
The involvement with the Black Panther Party, though, is something that set off some alarm bells with the FBI. Gary, tell us what you know about investigations into Jean.
Well, at the time, the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, the director, regarded the Black Panthers as the main threat to the internal security of the United States. And at the time, Jean was pregnant with her second child, and the FBI had wanted to discredit her in the eyes of the American public because they felt that she was somewhat of an influence in the average American. And so, in a nutshell, what they did was spread propaganda about her. And in the end, this rumor that was circulated was printed as fact in Newsweek magazine that the father of Jean Seberg's unborn child was not her husband's, but a Black activist she met in California.
And this was extremely difficult for her, and it was also compounded by the fact that that baby died, right?
Right.
Kelly, or Gary?
Oh, I'm sorry. Kelly, no, you can take it.
Okay.
Well, yeah, and it was a telephone conversation with Elaine Brown that the FBI, that gave them this idea. They misunderstood the conversation and thought they had a piece of information they could use against Jean. And they did use it, and actually it worked very effectively. It not only undermined Jean, but it created dissension within the Panthers themselves because they believed the story from within their organization. So it was a very effective program, mm-hmm. and very unfair. I mean, there were a number of prominent Americans at that time that were targeted with this disinformation program, and a lot of regular people too, who to this day don't realize they were targeted.
As I mentioned, that baby, it was born prematurely, and she died 2 days after her birth. And Jean held an open casket funeral in Marshalltown, Iowa. Gary, why did she do that?
It was to for anyone to see who wanted to see if the rumors were true or not, and that, in fact, the baby was white, Caucasian.
I think what Jean was so struck by, in a way, was that was the idea of her nation that she loved could use something that wasn't true, you know, to try to destroy her credibility. I think it was that notion of, you know, we've all run into it in life. You run up against something that's really, really unfair, and you feel like it just shouldn't stand, but it does. And I think it was that kind of frustration for Jean.
Well, the other thing with Jean, and this is something that we found that ran when we did interviews, this is something that came up again and again. Jean was somebody who was very compassionate. She was very genuine in her generosity. She wasn't somebody who was phony about giving. She sincerely cared about the people that she was supporting. She was completely against discrimination. She was somebody who was a fighter for civil rights, activism, and the struggle. And I think it completely blindsided her. Mm-hmm. It was such a shocking moment for her. It was realizing that her country was not there for her. You know, she loved her country, you know, and she believed in the civil rights movement. And I think it was such a shock. She did lose the baby. And I feel like it really played a part in her downfall from there.
What happened after that? I mean, she clearly was very sad about that. That was a difficult experience for her. Her career was declining. Gary, tell us what happened next.
Well, at the time when the rumor came out and Jean lost the baby, she was appearing in Airport, which was the top grossing film of 1970, so, and she was third billed. So, you know, so she still was riding high. But then after that, she never made another film in the United States. And she did suffer a breakdown, just could not get over the untruth of everything. And then she also suspected the FBI was behind all this.
Well, that was what was interesting in a way. When you read the transcript of that conversation, and the piece that ran in the LA Times referred to Jean as Miss A. Well, in talking on the phone amongst the Black Panther Party people, they would use a name rather than their own name, and hers was Aretha. So in other words, as soon as she saw that reference in the LA Times, she would have seen a connection between the FBI, the LA Times. She would have understood that she was being targeted. She would have understood that her career was being targeted. It just had to be a really dreadful moment in a way to realize that all the things she thought were happening and had told other people. She thought her phones were tapped. She thought she was being followed in various things. And people thought she was maybe just being paranoid. But all of that stuff turned out to be true.
Well, and she was going through a very difficult time personally as well. She and her husband divorced shortly before the birth of her daughter, and then her daughter died in 1972. She was married again to a director, Dennis Barry, and then again that marriage fell apart in 1979. She was with another man, and she said that he abused her. And in late August 1979, she disappeared. Gary, what happened?
Well, she was working on a film at the time, and there were plans for possibly another film in the fall with David Niven. She was planning to come back for another visit to Marshalltown. A lot of her visits back to Iowa were very private, but she did not report to the film set. I had spoken with Jean's father-in-law, John Barry, who was a film director as well, before his death, and you know, he was trying to convince the police that, you know, she's missing, something is terribly wrong. And at the time, Dennis Barry, her husband at the time, was here in the States. But eventually the police did take it seriously, but it took 8 days to find her body, and she was found in the back seat of her car, wedged between the front seat and the back seat, on the floor, wrapped in a blue blanket.
And at the time her death was ruled a suicide, she had barbiturates in her system?
Well, the thing is, the public or the press ruled it a suicide. The coroner's report that came out afterwards, he had marked it probable suicide, because the question is, yes, an overdose of barbiturates, but the alcohol level in her system was so high that there is no way she could have administered it to herself.
And there was no alcohol in the car with her?
I believe there's water bottles, or a water bottle.
So, Gary, what do you think happened?
The man she was with, I feel, had something to do with her death. No one knows where he is today, and he's probably not alive. He was an Algerian, and rumored to be connected with some shady characters. So I think something just went terribly wrong. But, you know, we won't know until someone investigates this further.
Callie, where do you leave it in the film?
Well, right where it is. We don't know. It isn't possible for Jean to have gotten into the car and driven herself to where she was with that level of alcohol and the pills and everything, and she wore glasses, needed glasses to drive, and was also not dressed like you would, you know, dress to go out someplace.
A lot of questions.
Yeah, it's just a mystery.
In bringing out this film and giving us insight into her life and into her work, what do you want people to take away from it, Kelly?
Well, I think Tammy and I both want people to appreciate Jean's life and her work, those contributions that she did make to the world of cinema, to the world of philanthropy, to the civil rights movement, and to appreciate that her life can't be boiled down to a few sound bites, that she was a very, very complex person, a very intelligent person, and that, you know, I guess her life story isn't, you know, it's not more important than any other Iowan's story in a sense, but it's no less important. And that when we consider people of note from the state, we should include on that list Jean Seberg.
Yes.
We just have 30 seconds left. Nancy, can you sum up what you feel Jean Seberg's legacy is in Marshalltown today?
I think that I can, and I'll frame it in reference to the festival. When we talk about her activism, we need to remember that when she was 12, she won a contest writing for the Animal Rescue League, right? At 14, she joined the NAACP. She seemed a person who always wanted to speak for those who didn't have a voice. And it's only right that we speak for her now.
Nancy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nancy Adams is one of the organizers of the Jean Seberg International Film Festival coming up next week. The movie we've been talking about, Movie Star, The Secret Lives of Jean Seberg, will premiere at that festival next week with additional showings on Saturday and Sunday. Kelly and Tammy Rundle, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And Gary McGee, thank you.
Thank you.
And Richard Ness, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Richard Ness is a professor of film and media studies at Western Illinois University. You can find out more about the film on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical support from Jason Burns today. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.